In the last one or two generations, there have really been maybe four major shifts in how we think about sexuality here in the West that have had a profound impact on us in more ways than we may know. And these are the four ways. Number one, sex has been disconnected from childbearing and family. You know, I think we forget that birth control as we know it today dates back to 1960. Like, it's fairly new. And it wasn't until 1972 that the Supreme Court finally legalized birth control for single people. Like, think about that for a moment. For our grandparents and their peers, it was illegal to use any form of contraception unless they were married, right? For most of human history, it wasn't an option to experience sexuality without at least a high risk of long-term responsibility. And one of the effects this has had is that it's made sex, the primary purpose of sex, for most people, pleasure over procreation, which is neither bad nor good. It's just a fundamentally different approach towards sexuality than the generations before us. So that's number one. Number two, major shift. Sex has been disconnected from marriage, right? Sex is no longer something reserved just for two people in a covenant relationship who made their vows to love each other till death do them part, and has been for nearly every human culture throughout history and still is throughout most of the world, right? This is new. This is something that's new because for most of the world, that's still very much the norm. And one of the effects of this is that for many people, it's created this anxiety around sexuality because you're never really sure if the person you've shared your body with is going to end up sticking around, right? It's entering into the deepest form of intimacy without the promise of long-term commitment. Number three, sex has been disconnected from love, emotion, and relational commitment. Think of the emergence of things like Tinder and think of the hookup culture in our day. Data shows that more and more people are delaying marriage to focus on career, right? Especially here in a city like San Francisco, that's very much true. And during that time, which can be anywhere from 5 to 10 to 20 years post-graduation, people still horny, y'all, right? People still want sex. What they don't want is all of the love and emotion and connection that go with it. Because if you've ever been in a serious relationship, you know that relationships are time-consuming, they're hard work, they're expensive, they're messy, they require sacrifice, exclusivity, money, energy, and effort. And who has time for all of that? And so eventually, people do want love and long-term commitment and et cetera, but just not now. And so for many young professionals, especially in urban cities like ours, people want sex without all the other stuff attached to it, right? Now, despite all these three shifts, none of this is new. In every time, in every place, you'll find people sleeping around outside of marriage, having sex for fun, for pleasure. None of this is new. But what is new is that more and more people are beginning to frame these shifts as moral progress and liberation from the oppression of traditional and religious systems, right? In fact, more and more people view those who hold ancient views of sexuality as behind the times or out of touch. Now, I know even within our community, there's a diverse array of thoughts around what is healthy sexuality and faith. But the fact is, these shifts are relatively new, and more, the public sentiment is these are signs of progress and liberation. All of which has led to a more recent shift in how we think about sexuality that we're just beginning to feel. And it's this: sex has been disconnected from people. Cue the explosive growth of the porn industry, estimated to bring in $97 billion annually, where you're able to explore your sexuality without another human being present. I'm sure you may be watching another person, but that's vastly different from interacting with that person in real life. There's even been a recent wave of people purchasing what I've read about sex robots. Have you guys heard about this? Apparently, there's a service available where you pick an anime character online to fall in love with and eventually marry, also known as your waifu. And then you buy a doll of that anime character to be delivered to your home. And new technologies emerging where it will allow you to have sex with that doll, to marry that doll. And with AI, you can now have a relationship with your character and pre-program them to say or do whatever you want. And these aren't just stereotypical loners on the fringe anymore. These are everyday people. Like, think of the movie Her. Have you guys seen Her a few years back? And more recently, the movie that came out called Companion. Like, these aren't just things that are way off in some dystopian future. It's here, it's now, and it's happening. Sex disconnected from people. But what's really interesting is the effect that this shift has had on our world. Data shows that young people are having less sex than they have in 50 years. Which, I mean, low key, isn't that a good thing, Pastor Mickey? Like, isn't that what the church, isn't that what Christians want? Don't we want less young people having sex, less risk of unplanned pregnancies and such? But here's the catch. The reason why young people are having less sex is because of the effects of the digital age. Sure, porn, but even deeper, just the fact that so many of our interactions with other people happen behind a screen. In other words, people don't know how to interact with other humans IRL, in real life, in person anymore. And in turn, people don't know how to flirt anymore. I read this article, this fascinating article about how the modern day generation, they don't know how to flirt. They call it what, Riz these days? I'm so behind the times. I don't know. But people do not know how to have normal conversations, how to interact with people in real life. And usually to have sex with somebody, you kind of have to seduce them. And in order to seduce them, you kind of have to know how to have a conversation first. But statistics show that people don't know how to have basic human interactions in real life anymore. All this to say, there is a staggering amount of pain and confusion around the topic of sexuality in our world today. You know, I mentioned last week that we often hear people say, like, what's the big deal? Lighten up. It's just sex. Who's ever been hurt by just a little bit of sex? To which I'd say, who hasn't been hurt by sex? Who hasn't been hurt by divorce, by infidelity, by insecurity, by porn addiction, by trust issues, by shame, by body image issues? All of us have struggled in some shape or form with sexuality. Ron Rollheiser has this to say, the church has always struggled with sex, but so have everyone else. There aren't any cultures, religious or secular, pre-modern or modern, post-modern or post-religious, that exhibit a truly healthy sexual ethos. Every church and every culture struggles with integrating sexual energy, if not in its creed about sex, at least in the living out of that creed. Secular culture looks at the church and accuses it of being uptight and anti-erotic. Partly this is true, but the church might well protest that much of its sexual reticence is rooted in the fact that it is one of the few voices still remaining who are challenging anyone towards sexual responsibility. As well, the church might also challenge any culture that claims to have found the key to healthy sexuality to step forward and show the evidence. No culture will take up that claim. Everyone is struggling. I mean, it's kind of cool these days to bash on the church for being behind the times and like sexually regressive. But look out in the world too. Like, if really sexual liberation is the answer to our sexual woes, shouldn't the data show it? But data shows that it's just as bad out there. No one seems to have the answer, and all of us are running around hurt and confused when it comes to the topic of sexuality. All this to say, you and I are not alone. I want us to look to 1 Thessalonians 4:3-8. This is what Paul writes. He says, it is God's will that you should be sanctified, that you should avoid sexual immorality, that each of you should learn to control your body in a way that is holy and honorable, not in passionate lust like the pagans who do not know God, and that in this matter no one should wrong or take advantage of a brother or sister, for God did not call us to be impure, but to live a holy life. Therefore, anyone who rejects this instruction does not reject a human being, but God, the very God who gives you his Holy Spirit. The question that we're begging to ask here in the church is, does Jesus have a vision for sexuality that's better than what we've known. A vision for sexuality that actually leads to wholeness, freedom, and life. A vision for sexuality that doesn't cause us to suppress it out of fear or reduce it to something purely physical. A vision for sexuality that doesn't lead to exploitation or selfish lust. Luckily for you and I, the answer is yes. And it's a vision for what's known as sexual formation. I used the term last week, but we're going to expound more upon it today. What do I mean when I say sexual formation? Now, when we think of sexuality, and I think especially when we talk about it in the church, we tend to focus on what we do or why we do it, right? We tend to focus on the action or the habit or the practice, the act of sex, the habit of watching porn, etc. But Jesus asks a bigger question than just why do I do what I do and what do I do? Jesus asks the bigger question, who am I becoming by what I am doing? And that changes everything. In other words, what if instead of asking, is this right or is this wrong? Is this sinful or is this righteous? Like, does this make Jesus weep or does this make him smile? We asked, who am I being formed into by doing what I'm doing? In other words, instead of focusing on the practice or the act, we ask, we take it a step further, who am I becoming by engaging in the things that I'm doing in the way that I am? Sexual formation, when we use that term, it's surrendering our sexuality to Jesus, but not the practices or the habits or the acts. It's peeling it a layer back and saying, God, who are you forming me through the sexual practices that I engage in? It's surrendering our sexuality to Jesus and allowing him to form us through it. Now, the million-dollar question is, how do we do this? Well, I believe that it begins with adopting Jesus' vision for sexuality. According to John Tyson, there are four pillars of Jesus' vision for human sexuality. The first, sexuality reminds us of the story that we belong to, right? Sex is a signpost pointing us to something greater, something beyond ourselves. Remember, we talked about it a little bit last week. In the beginning, Adam and Eve were naked and unashamed. And we define sexuality not as just a physical act of sex, but a deep longing or desire to know and be known by others. And in the beginning, Adam and Eve were naked and unashamed. They experienced the purest form of intimacy, the purest form of sexuality. There was no fear, no insecurity, no shame. They were fully seen, known, and loved. And perhaps the deepest consequence of sin was the introduction of shame. And it hasn't gone anywhere, right? We're always hiding and concealing ourselves from one another in shame, afraid to let people see all of who we are. And I think there's a deep pain that so many people in the world carry, and it's this aching for intimacy, an aching to truly be seen, known, and loved. There was this New York Times article called What's Lust Got to Do With It, written by Maureen Down, and she has this to say. Getting naked and having sex with strangers is hard, she tells me. We portray it as fun and we pretend it's fun, but people crave intimacy, which is not easy to create in a hookup. That's why Britain just appointed a loneliness minister. Do you guys know that? Britain has a loneliness minister. Because for all the moral progressions they claim to have made, people are still lonely as ever. Like, I might try to apply for a job like that. Like, try to be a loneliest minister in the United States. That's pretty cool. But I believe deep down, every single one of us longs for that naked and unashamed kind of connection and union with one another and with God. And sex reminds us of the story that we belong to. What sex is in its most beautiful form is a taste of Eden, an experience of intimacy where you don't have to hide in shame anymore, where you can be fully vulnerable and fully accepted, where you, another can see you and know you and still choose to love you completely. Yet think about it. How many people in our world engage in sexual activity but feel less seen than ever before? Who feel shame? Who feel unknown and unloved? Who feel used? It's a pure distortion of what sexuality was meant for. It was meant to show us and remind us of the story that we belong to. Sex points us to the divine. All of it points to the story of what Jesus has done for us. Jesus, who's seen us naked and vulnerable and at our worst, got naked and vulnerable himself on the cross on our behalf and gave himself to us unconditionally. This is the story we belong to. And so sex reminds us of the story we belong to. But number two, a second pillar of Jesus' vision for sexuality. Sexuality is a holistic integration with another person. Now, I really do believe sex is more than just physicality. It's more than just flesh pounding on flesh. Sex is a physical act that's meant to express all of our heart, mind, and soul. But when we reduce sex to something just physical, it's a cheap imitation of what it's truly meant to be. Sex is a reminder in our bodies of what we're doing with the rest of our lives. When I give you my body, it's a sign of everything that comes with it: my commitment, my devotion, my finances, my dreams, my desires, my love. It's a physical expression of a holistic devotion. You know, that's why, I mean, just to be blunt, Krista and I, we saved sex until we got married. And when we did have sex, it was so beautiful because it was a representation not just of what our bodies were feeling, but of our entire lives oriented to say, I do in sickness or in health. I will never leave you, even if my body starts decaying, even if you're sick, even if we're broke. It's our bodies expressing what our entire lives is devoting. And that's what sex is meant to be. Number three, sexuality is tied to our transformation. Ron Rollheiser once again says, but when you don't follow your desires, you have to examine your desires. And that produces a chaste tension and introspection about why we want what we want. You know, this is why I think seasons of fasting are a lost art in the church. They're so important. They're so transformative and revealing. It's only in our abstinence of something that we begin to ask, why do I miss this so much? Why do I crave this so much? And you begin asking, what is my relationship with this? Without the absence of it, there's no reason to ask those questions. We all know that if you spoil a child growing up and give them anything and everything they want, you end up deforming their character. Yet when we grow up, is that not how many of us live? We demand whatever we want, whenever we want, especially when it comes to our sexual appetites, but rarely does this produce life-giving love for other people. It produces selfishness. It produces impatience. It produces anxiety. It produces lust rather than love. And last, the fourth pillar, sexuality is a witness to the world. Followers of Jesus get to model a form of sexuality that reflects respect and humanity, not commodification and abuse. Right? Sexuality practiced in the way of Jesus leads to healing and restoration, not exploitation. I find fascinating that one of the ways the early church won over the Roman Empire was through their witness, and specifically in three areas. Number one, their radical generosity, how generous they were with their resources, with their time, even with their money. And number two, their radical forgiveness. Many of them died forgiving the people that were killing them, forgiving their enemies. But number three, it was their radical sexuality. The honor and dignity and faithfulness exhibited in Christian marriages and relationships were so different from the culture, so countercultural that it won the Roman Empire over. Their commitment to raising a family in love, for not using their offspring, for not using their spouses, this was radical. And so these four pillars make up the vision for Jesus' vision for sexuality. And so in the midst of the pain and confusion around sexuality in our world, Jesus gives us a clear vision of sexuality that leads to life. Now, I want to spend the rest of our time examining two things that I think are deeply relevant in our world today that we encounter on a daily basis as it relates to our sexuality, but I want us to examine them through the lens of spiritual and sexual formation. Now, once again, we're moving away from labeling things as sinful or unsinful, right or wrong. I think oftentimes that can be incredibly reductive and harmful. And maybe if you've grown up in the church, that's why you kind of have a sour taste in your mouth when it comes to the topic of sexuality. But instead, with everything we talk about today, I want us to ask the question, once again, circling back to sexual formation, who am I becoming by what I'm doing? What kind of person am I being formed into by engaging this in the way that I am? Now, with these topics, I'm not giving you a yes or no, right or wrong, but I'm inviting you to ask the challenging question, the probing questions. Who am I becoming by what I'm doing? Not through the lens of morality or behavior modification or shame, but through the lens of formation. Now, the two things I want to talk about today, pornography and dating apps, right? Amazing, deeply relevant things that we experience every day in our world. The first, pornography. Statistics vary, but I think it's safe to say everyone has looked at porn. And usually, before the statistics said that men are far more likely to watch porn than women, but now that is catching up. And so the statistics are practically identical inside of the church and outside of the church today. There's no difference. And with nearly unrestricted access at the tip of our fingers, porn addiction has now emerged as a global crisis. I mean, you know it's bad when there are countless movements outside of the church of people who are fighting against porn use because they know how bad it is for us. The scary thing about porn is that it literally rewires our brains. When researchers compared porn users versus non-users, they found that the more porn a person viewed, the less that the reward center activated when porn images were flashed on screen. This is why porn has been getting increasingly more and more violent, more aggressive, more hardcore, and more dehumanizing, because simply put, regular sex just doesn't cut it anymore. Our brains have literally been rewired. Studies have shown that frequency of porn usage leads to a decrease in empathy, compassion, and understanding for other people. It also affects our sexual preferences. Studies show that porn use correlates with less sexual and relational satisfaction overall. And they say that those viewing porn regularly report a higher level of a willingness to commit rape, sexual callousness, and sexually aggressive behavior. This is not just the church pointing its finger at something that they think is dirty and should be morally reprehensible. These are actual statistics that show the harm that pornography can have for the human brain. In a recent survey of 16 to 18-year-old Americans, nearly every participant reported learning how to have sex by watching porn. And it's reported that many young women felt pressure to play out the scripts that their male partners had learned from pornography. Many of them felt coerced into having sex in uncomfortable positions, faking sexual responses, and consenting to painful and unpleasant acts in order to please the men they were sleeping with. Pope John Paul famously said, "There's no dignity when the human dimension is eliminated from the person." In short, the problem with pornography is not that it shows too much of a person, it's that it shows far too little. And so morality aside, wrong or right aside, what does God say about this aside? Who are we becoming when we watch porn? Emotionally, relationally, mentally, even physically, what's happening to our very brains? Is this making me more like Christ? Is this bringing me more life? I want us to ask the question. Number two, dating. Cue dating apps. Praise the Lord that Krista and I narrowly avoided the meteoric rise of dating apps. Many of you guys are in that season today. And so I just want to start by saying I have zero experience when it comes to the dating app world, but I've been a pastor here in San Francisco for long enough, for close to 10 years. So I've heard firsthand from countless people the horror stories and how hard and challenging and confusing it is to navigate dating apps. And so because I don't know much, I came across this article in Vanity Fair through John Tyson's Sermon on Sexuality titled Tinder and Hookup Culture Promotion. So I'm going to let it speak for itself about our current dating app culture landscape, and maybe some of you could resonate with some of the stuff. So quote, this is what someone says, "With these dating apps, you're always sort of prowling. You could talk to two or three girls at a bar and pick the best one. Or you can swipe a couple hundred people a day. The sample size is so much larger. It's setting up two or three Tinder dates a week, and chances are sleeping with all of them, so you can rack up 100 girls you slept with in a year. There's a concept of what's called Tinderella. It's a girl that you sleep with before midnight, but not after midnight. And there's the Tinder King, a guy who could get someone to sleep with them based on their text game, possibly the mastery of emojis only. What is this world? What is this world? Another quote from this article. I sort of play that I want to be a boyfriend kind of guy in order to win them over, but then they start wanting me to care and I just don't. Another quote. It's rare for a woman in our generation to meet a man who treats her like a priority instead of an option. They start with send me nudes, or they say something like, I'm looking for something quick within the next 10 or 15 minutes. Are you available? Okay, you're a mile away. Tell me your location. It's straight efficiency. Another quote. If he texts you before midnight, he actually likes you as a person. If it's after midnight, it's just for your body. Another quote, I hooked up with three girls thanks to the internet, all off Tinder in the course of four nights, and I spent a total of $80 on all three girls. Another quote, I had sex with a guy, and he ignored me as I got dressed, and I saw he was back on Tinder. Last quote. A few young women admitted to me that they use dating apps as a way to get free meals. I call it Tinder food stamps. It's pretty clever. But sad, right? This is the state of our dating app world and culture. Again, the question we need to ask is not is this sinful or should I or could I, but who am I becoming by what I'm doing? I really believe that we need spirit-filled, mature followers of Jesus on these dating apps who show the upside-down ways of the kingdom. Imagine if followers of Jesus embody dignity and respect and kindness in a dating app culture of commodification, selfishness, and quick sex. C.S. Lewis, he wrote this famous book on the four loves, where he articulates four kinds of love that human beings experience in society. The first, he says, is eros love or erotic love, right? It's the sexual intimacy, that kind of love. Then there's storge love, which is a love that's sort of like a nostalgic excitement and wonder kind of love. Then there's philia love, which is friendship and brotherly love, right? It's cultivating friendship with another human being. And last is agape love, which is other-centered sacrificial care. It's love for the sake of loving someone else without thinking of what you're getting in return. Now, dating app culture has changed the order of our loves and flipped it upside down. Number one, eros. Are they hot? Can I sleep with them? Number two, storge. Can I have an exciting and fun time with them? Number three, philia. After I've slept with them and had a fun time with them, then I begin considering, can I build a friendship with them? And then lastly, agape. If we're friends, maybe we could spend our lives together and consider marriage. But the way of Jesus actually reverses the disorder of the loves in our culture. It puts number one, agape. When I view people that I want to date, I ask, am I willing to offer them sacrificial love and care and respect and dignity in the way of Jesus? Number two, then we ask, are we friends who connect well and enjoy being around each other? Which leads to number three, then can we build a life of excitement, adventure, and fun and wonder together? And lastly, when those things are in place, I will give you my eros love as a sign of all that has come before it. Isn't that beautiful? When you think about how you approach dating, how you approach dating apps, is it the way of the world or the way of Jesus? Once again, not is how I'm dating right or wrong, but who am I becoming by how I approach dating, how I interact with dating app culture? I want to close with this beautiful imagery in I mean, almost every pastor has used this by now, but there's this, the art of kintsugi, right, in Japanese culture. It's this art of taking these broken pieces and building it together. Here in American culture, right, if something breaks, we toss it or we get something new. But there's this beautiful form of art in Japan culture where they take these broken pieces and they build or they put piece it together in a beautiful way. And I love that they leave the gold marks to show that it was once broken, to show that even broken things can have intrinsic beauty and can be put back together to make something whole. I think for many of us, it's safe to say that we have been broken by the messages and experiences of sexuality that we've experienced in our world. And some of us wonder if we could ever be put back together again. But the hope of Jesus and the vision for sexual formation and wholeness that Jesus gives us is one that says there is hope for us to be whole again. And so if you've been broken, if you've experienced pain and disappointment and loss and frustration and doubt, if you've ever experienced any kind of pain related to sexual brokenness, the hope of the gospel and the hope of Jesus and the vision of Jesus is piecing us back together to make us something beautiful.